Tottenham story is this. It's time to change the situation if Tottenham want to change.
I love to win, mate. That's the main thing. Hopefully I can fulfil those dreams and aspirations of every Tottenham supporter.
And still Ricky Villa. What a fantastic run. He scored.
That's going to have a crack. He is, you know. Oh, he's there.
Kane is the record.
Here's Lucas Moura.
Oh, they've done it.
I'm loving big engines instead.
Guess I'm a Spurs fan now then.
Hello, welcome to the Tottenham Way podcast. I'm Dan Kilpatrick. I'm with Tom Barkley. We've both just got home from the North London Derby and jumped on Zoom to react. So Tom, let's get straight into it and talk about a fairly strange, chaotic, entertaining, as it often is, match this afternoon. Arsenal racing into a 3-0 lead by half time. It looked like it could be a real humiliation for Spurs and a landmark result for Arsenal. Spurs rallied, as they often do at home, in the second half. I made it 3-2, but couldn't get that late equaliser. What were your overall impressions of the game and Spurs' performance?
Yeah, hi, Dan. It was a strange game because of that late rally, sort of changing the context of what we thought it was going to be when they were 3-0 down at half-time. And let's be honest, if it weren't for a Vicario top save from Saka at the start of the second half, it would have been even worse. And I was doing Spurs' colour piece for our paper, so to sort of give readers an understanding of that, you have a match report, which is just sort of nuts and bolts of it, and then a colour piece is more a focus on one particular thing. And being the Spurs reporter, it was Tottenham and Ange's seeming reluctance to adapt at times, which I know is a bugbear of quite a lot of fans. You know, with the high line and the tactical approach, and I do think that reared its head quite a lot today from that first half performance. You mentioned, you know, they scored goals, they made it entertaining, and that is something that is always going to happen with Ange Postecoglou. His teams are always going to create chances, and I think that everyone, barring Tottenham's, the fans of Tottenham's rivals, should be appreciative of that in the Premier League, because it always means that their games are great to watch. But in terms of where Postecoglou wants this team to go and to be genuine title challengers next season, which he has publicly stated as his aim, I just think this showed how far off they are from achieving that. And I don't think it's just a personnel issue, albeit you could definitely make a case for Destiny Udogi being a big miss today, even though his form hasn't been quite as strong in the last couple of months. He was excellent in the 2-2 draw at the Emirates, keeping Saka quiet. And I think Ben Davis, as much as I think he's a great servant, I do think he just doesn't fit this system. And he struggled in this game. So he was missing. But I don't, but apart from that, and the fact that the shield in front of the back four is a problem and is something that I think Spurs may even address potentially in the summer transfer market. But when you look at Van de Ven, you look at Romero, you look at Porro, look at Vicario, these are, you know, top class players. And I don't think you can just put it down to you know, needing new players. I think there's a question mark around Postecoglou's reluctance to adapt, which I personally think going forward he needs to do. Not all the time, but in certain games. And I think this game sort of highlighted that more than anything else, any other game I can think of this season.
I always feel like the happy clapper on this podcast because I'm fairly convinced by what Postecoglou is trying to do. And I said to you just before we started recording, I do think a lot of Spurs fans should just hold their nerve. I understand that it's grim getting beaten 4-0 at Newcastle and losing at home to your rivals, but rebuilds are always difficult. Rome wasn't built in a day. This is what happens to teams when they're on the cusp of being good, when they're trying to change the style of play and change the system. But I mean, I understand what you're saying. Of course I do. But for me, the reason it was a strange game, and I said that in the intro to the pod, was because I didn't really feel like it was a 3-0 half-time. In fact, I didn't feel at all like it was a 3-0 first half.
No, I agree with that.
I don't think Arsenal deserved to be that far ahead. And I didn't really feel like Spurs did enough to get two goals back in the second half, to be honest. And in my heart of hearts, I'm not sure I was ever really convinced Spurs were going to find an equaliser against that Arsenal side either. So it all kind of felt like, it felt like there were five goals that were almost kind of out of context, really. I thought Spurs were actually in control of the first half pretty well. But the problem is they've got two massive weaknesses, and one is from set pieces. They're terrible at defending, particularly corners. And the other is they're far too open in transition, which Newcastle exposed and Arsenal exposed with the Saka goal. And I think Arsenal did what top teams do, which is ruthlessly hone in on their opponent's weaknesses and exploit them. And they did that by scoring two goals from corners and by scoring the Saka goal on the counter. And I think, you know, Arteta deserves credit for that because he kind of set up Arsenal a bit differently today. They were happy to let Spurs have the ball in front of them and they counterpunched really well at times.
Isn't that the point, though? Isn't that the point? The exact point right there is he changed it up. He did something slightly different to counteract that. And I just think playing the same way every game, particularly against a team like Arsenal, it just becomes predictable. It's the same with when you look at Brighton this season. You know, there are lots of like extenuating factors and injuries and all that kind of thing. Same for Tottenham. But they are becoming, when you go for such a sort of certain way of playing every game without any kind of flexibility.
But I think that's unfair. I mean, Ange's, you do not get to be a Premier League manager. You don't get to be Tottenham manager unless you've got some flexibility in his game. And I do think we've been through this. He has non-negotiables, which are you play a high line, you press, you try and dominate possession and you attack. But obviously within that, there are changes. And today he brought in Højbjerg. I think that was a notable change. I mean, it didn't work for me. And obviously he scored the own goal to break the deadlock. But he is obviously prepared to make tweaks within that. I'll tell you what, should we talk about set pieces? Because I feel like that's an interesting area where I'm slightly with you, because his comments afterwards I thought were a bit concerning. He doesn't seem to grasp, or perhaps he grasps, but he's not saying so publicly.
Yeah, I think that's the key. I don't know if he really just wants to talk about it publicly, particularly after games. I find post-match press conferences are quite a bit of a means to an end with Ange Postecoglou.
So you were in there. So tell the listeners what he said about the set pieces.
Well, he's been asked about set pieces for a while now, and we kind of know that he can be a bit prickly around them. And it was Ali Gold asking that, who asked it in like the nicest way you could, sort of framing it that when we've asked before about a potential issue with set pieces, his answer has pretty much been he hasn't got a big enough sample size to make any clear judgments on. But because it's been going on for such a long time now, Ali's question was effectively, do you feel like you can start drawing some conclusions? Because we worked it out, the 14th goal they've conceded from set pieces this season. And you know, it took me a while to sort of completely agree with everyone that Vicario was a weak point from set pieces. I was slow on the uptake on that one. He clearly is. I mean, Declan Rice was targeting that with some really great sort of accuracy, to be fair, today, moment after moment, and it obviously cost them two goals, because it's not just the fact that they couldn't clear it, it's the fact that he didn't dominate the area, and that's a concern. But anyway, Postecoglou's response was effectively, if I thought it was all about just fixing set pieces, I would put all my efforts into that, but I think it's the bigger picture, which I know that you're big on sort of agreeing with his point of that, and I broadly am as well. I do think it's not all about the sort of here and now. It's about the direction they're going in. But
his comments on set pieces, I find a bit worrying.
Well, I'm not sure I quite sort of not believe him. I just don't think he's given the whole game away there. It must be a concern.
Yeah, I don't, you're right. But it is a massive weakness for Spurs. And it's cost them so many points this season. And I think if you look at those 14 goals you mentioned and how many points they cost Spurs, you know, in very simplistic terms, that could literally be the difference between fifth and fourth, or even being in touch with the title race. You know, I'm not saying Spurs deserve to be in the title race, but it's not a marginal gain. It's whatever the opposite of a marginal gain is, a massive gain. And I find it strange that he has come out and said he doesn't want to hire a set-piece coach, because that's what all Spurs rivals are doing. Arsenal have obviously done it. They've got Nicholas Hover. Chelsea are building a whole department around this guy they're poaching from Brighton. City have done it. So you feel like Spurs will just be missing out on a huge part of the game and a huge area where they can take big strides. And obviously they had a good set-piece coach in Gianni Vio. So unless Ange is you know, convinced that kind of Mason and Chris Davis and the others are kind of just as good as a set piece coach in this area of the game, that then I think it strikes me as strange that Spurs aren't hiring one.
Yeah, I mean, specifically it's Mason and Mili Jedinek, isn't it? One's on the attacking set pieces, one's defending them. And yeah, I mean, the longer this continues, the more he's going to get those questions about whether he should employ one or change it up or wherever it might be. And that's only fair because the results are there. And you look at Arsenal, who are really good at scoring set pieces. I think they're top of the league on that front. You're right, absolutely right. From the marginal gain point of view, it makes a huge difference. But personally, I was more worried about the manner of the Saka goal for where Spurs are going forward. And I know it's a bigger, wider debate, and you want to talk about this in depth with the other guys in the week of, you know, the bigger picture versus the here and now. I suppose just briefly, my point isn't, I'm generally with you. I think the bigger picture is still more important at this point, but I still think personally, I still think there can be a bit of flexibility. I think I've said it from the start of the season that any manager that sticks to just one way, no matter what, I get it, particularly at the beginning where you're trying to sort of instill habits and a belief system and this idea that we play this one way. But all I can do is look at Arteta and the way he's adapted since. And you're right, he's far down the line of his process compared to where Postecoglou is now. And that's a real sign for optimism, is the fact that where Postecoglou is now is far higher than where Arteta was in his first couple of years. But I just look at the adaptation, particularly when Arsenal went to City and the way they played there, and I guess it's the horses for courses. And I know it sounds like a bit blunt and doesn't sound particularly sophisticated in the age of statistics and everyone sort of drilling down into making the game more complicated. But I do really think that those basics are still relevant. And it's rare that you'll see anyone in the history of the Premier League. And that's a key difference as well. It may have worked in Scotland and he's been a fantastic manager. I'm all in on him on that front, but the Premier League is different. It's you're going up against the best every week. And I just think the lack of flexibility there will mean that getting to where he wants them to, and I might be wrong, maybe they'll sign a couple of players in the summer and that will be so transformational for the way he wants to play that they'll kick on to the next level. And I'm sure they will improve, but I still think I'd be surprised, put it that way, if there isn't a bit of a shift, like Arteta has shown in this game, in that City game, compared to what he may have done a couple of years ago.
But that's it for me. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I just think it's very easy to look at a team like Arsenal who are 4.5 years into a project and say, oh, didn't they adapt well when they've got the squad Arteta wants? They've had, 8-9 transfer windows to bring in his players and become this really flexible, kind of versatile winning machine, who have obviously evolved massively even from last year when they were kind of much more attacking and flair, but had this soft centre and these questions about the mentality. They're not really like that anymore. Today was a bit of an outlier for them. It was chaotic and they're normally very in control. So I think it's far easier to talk about how well a team's kind of adapted when they're at that stage of their development. Whereas Postecoglou's had 2 transfer windows, 1 summer, and is still kind of bedding in his style of play. And I just think it would be really odd if he started saying, OK, Arsenal are coming to town today, boys, the top of the league. We're going to counterpunch, you know, we're going to drop the line back 4 or 5 yards and we're going to try and hit them on the break with Sonny's pace and Werner's pace. And I don't know, I don't think that would be effective. And I think if you start compromising on your principles, you just end up with Ten Hag's United, you know, a side that doesn't really have an identity and doesn't really know what they're doing. You know, they were doing very well when he was sticking to his guns. And then as soon as players started getting injured and he kind of failed to hold his nerve, they went completely off the boil this season. So I think we could endlessly go around in circles, but
I do think it's, I know we're going endlessly around in circles, but I think the reason we're talking about it specifically is because of this game. I do think this is like a bit of a microcosm, a bit of a case study of that particular debate.
On this game, like, as I said, like, the second goal was a brilliant breakaway goal from Arsenal, and it was a great finish, you know, trademark finish from Saka, wasn't it? But I think Arsenal and Saka can kind of do that to any team. I mean, they are a top, top side. We have to, you know, accept that when we're assessing Spurs. And then the other two goals were this glaring weakness that Spurs have on set pieces. And I've said I'm a bit worried about kind of Ange's unwillingness to hire a coach and sort of address that, seemingly publicly at least, full on. But I don't know how... I wouldn't say this was a classic example of his sort of failure to adapt or his commitment to his principles kind of costing Spurs, really. Maybe Newcastle would be a better example of that, I think, than this game.
Fair enough. The key moments in the game. I just feel like the second goal was such a killer goal.
It was. I mean, and should we talk about briefly VAR? I mean, I know people are bored of hearing about this as well, but it was a huge moment, I thought, a 1-1, and it kind of sapped the momentum out of Spurs a little bit. They'd responded so well to the first goal, and then the Van de Ven equaliser was ruled out for another toenail offside.
I don't really know what there is more to say about it. It sucked. But by the letter of the law and all that, there isn't really much of an argument against it. I hate what it's done to the game.
I mean, I think there is an argument against it, which has been made by others in the last few weeks in light of the Man United Coventry decision and others. But it just strikes me that it's not what VAR was brought in for. Pre-VAR, everyone would have looked at that and said, "Oh, he's level. That's fine." And I think we're legislating on margins that don't need to be legislated on. This wasn't a problem that existed pre-VAR. The problems that existed were when players were kind of 2 or 3 yards offside and the linesman missed it. But that's what might be the case I would make. But yeah, you're right. We're going over old ground here.
No, I'm with you. All I'll add is Postecoglou touched on it in his post-match press conference. And for those of us who've been in so many of them, it's nothing new to what we were hearing in terms. And he said that himself, you know, my views on VAR are clear. I feel like games are being refereed, not in the stadium, but down in Stockley Park. And I can't celebrate goals anymore because I'm waiting for someone, you know, however many miles away to tell me whether it's been a goal or not. And I think he speaks for everyone. That is Ange at his man of the people, speaking for everyone's best, really, isn't he, on this topic? But as he also...
To provide a bit of balance, I mean, even the Spurs penalty, which I think was a penalty, Rice has kicked Davis, I didn't really like VAR getting involved in that because the referee's clearly seen it. Michael Oliver's, you can see on the replay, is a few yards away. He's got a clear view of it. He's decided it's not a penalty. And then, to Ange's point, there's just another referee in Stockwell Park who has said, "Oh, well, actually, I think that is a penalty." And you're just re-refereeing the game. You've just got two referees. It's all subjective. I mean, there will be more debatable calls than this one, which I think was a pen. But, I mean, the Chelsea-Villa one, for instance, that goes either way, doesn't it? That kind of shove. And it's, again, I just think... If Michael Oliver's seen it and not given a penalty, then that's his decision. He's the referee. Why is someone else saying, "Well, actually, I think that's a penalty"?
Yeah. I'll put the genie back in the bottle.
It's draining. And I genuinely think it's ruining the sport, slowly strangling it and squeezing the life out of it. But there you go. Let's talk about the bigger picture for Spurs. I mean, top four looking tough now.
Yeah. I don't think they've been playing well enough, to be honest, to have overhauled Villa. I know they've got the games in hand, but I think Villa... And actually, funny enough, I watched the second half of the Chelsea game. Chelsea were amazing and Villa really struggled. So they can be got at and they're not by any means infallible. I just don't feel like Tottenham... I feel like it's been a while since they put together a really convincing performance. I guess Villa away, but even in the first half there, I mean, they just sort of blitzed them in the second half out of nowhere. And that is a worry. I mean, maybe that's just... I think maybe teams are starting to work them out. Tiredness. I definitely think there's a lot of merit in his argument, which you have a lot of credence in, about the stop-start nature of this season. I don't think that helps. I know on the paper, a lot of fans will go, "You've had 2 weeks off," and I don't think that helps. I think they much would have rather played at least a week ago to be fresh for this game and to be sort of sharp. So there is that, but I just the nature of Spurs at the moment is you just don't know what you're going to get, and there are times when they can go away to seemingly not average opposition. I don't think they'll ever get battered by a Sheffield United, but Fulham away, for example, they were well beaten. The first one of that this season that I really remember is the Brighton away when they were 4-0 down. I know they got a couple of goals back late on to sort of paper over the cracks in that match, but they do seem to be capable of doing this, and that's what I, you know, doesn't give me a lot of confidence that they'd be able to make up the short haul. And just not enough players are sort of playing well enough. And there's a lot of debate you could be had over why James Maddison, it's not clicking for him. Is it purely because he hasn't ever recaptured that sharpness since his injury? Or is it the fact that the way the team are playing doesn't seem to involve him as much? Is it other teams countering his threats? I mean, it's probably a combination of all of those things. I mean, Werner getting injured today, we'll see what happens. I think Ange after the game said he wasn't quite sure. He said he felt his hamstring. That is a blow, because whatever you think about Timo Werner, he does affect the game, and I don't think that can be said of Dejan Kulusevski every match.
I thought he was good today.
Yeah, but in every game, I feel like Werner in every game, there's a moment where he could either win it, lose it, whatever. He does things because of that frightening pace and that approach. But at the same time, I almost feel like sometimes Spurs play at least easier on the eye without him in the team. So I don't know. That would be interesting going forward. But
would you think there's a case for dropping Maddison against Chelsea and playing Kulusevski at 10 with maybe Johnson and Richarlison?
Well, I mean,
next to Son. I think there is.
Is Lo Celso complete? Is Lo Celso fit at the moment? I'm trying to think. Was he left on the bench?
He came on today for the last 3 minutes of normal time. He just doesn't seem to be in contention to start games.
No.
So I think Kulusevski's the alternative option to start at number 10.
Well, I'm a fan of Kulusevski at number 10. I thought when he came in when Maddison was injured, that was one of the sort of silver linings of Maddison being out. I just feel like, said it a million times, but I feel he's way less predictable when he plays in the middle. Funnily enough, all the sort of neat little flicks and tricks, which I don't think you see enough of when he plays out wide. Maybe it's just literally the body angle that he's coming in at, playing in that position. He doesn't really seem to do that. But suddenly in the middle, he becomes this kind of agent of chaos that things can happen around him. I wouldn't be against it. I mean, Maddison, was he taken off on 62 minutes today, being completely ineffectual?
It seems to be a pattern, really. So I think if Ange's obviously acknowledging that he's not impacting games and bringing him off.
If you were Maddison right now, I know this isn't an England podcast, but he's a player, you know, he is Tottenham's representative for England. And I know it's, what, 26-man squad now. So I'd be pretty shocked if he wasn't in the squad, given how Southgate generally, you know, it takes a while to get in. But once you're in, you have to do quite a lot to get out of it. So I would have thought he'd stick with him, and he made that assist in the last international camp against Belgium for that last minute goal for Bellingham. So, you know, he's got that kind of in his favour. But with the way like Eberechi Eze, when he's fit, is playing, I do think he needs to be looking over his shoulder. But more to the point, from Tottenham's point of view, I don't know what, it's hard to say. I mean, why do you think he's not even close to firing on all cylinders at the moment?
For me, I think it's a consequence of, I mean, Andrew's spoken about this a few times, but the Spurs still seem way off clicking in the final third. It all seems far too clunky. I think you only catch kind of glimpses of them actually looking fluid there. And I think teams, including Arsenal, so not even smaller teams, have just worked out that if you put a lot of men behind the ball in the box, Spurs are going to struggle to kind of find a way through. And I think there's a lot of pressure on Maddison to unlock that. And at the moment, it's all a bit clunky in front of him. And it just doesn't really feel like Spurs know what they should be doing in a lot of those positions. And I feel like that's a big factor in it. Just the fact that he's not part of this team that's a kind of well-oiled machine at the moment. It's a team that's looking pretty rusty and kind of not really sure where everyone needs to be and what everyone needs to be doing. I also think there's probably a confidence element. I think he's probably forcing it a bit. And then a fitness element as well, I guess. He hasn't really ever recovered that sharpness from the first 11 games since he got injured against Chelsea. And again, to your point about the stop-start season, I think that genuinely isn't helping. You know, Maddison will probably want to play against Chelsea because he'll want to play three games this week, because it would have been a while since he's done that, I imagine. But I think there's now a pretty compelling case to give Kulusevski a go at 10 and play Johnson and Richarlison, who I thought came on and made a difference today for Spurs, kind of provided a focal point. Let's talk a little bit about the Chelsea game. I mean, back to your point, really, about Ange skepticism. I think Spurs fans should hold their nerve, as I said, near the top, and kind of view this season, view the whole pie, as it were, and view this the bigger picture. But I do think, you know, another defeat for Chelsea, and Ange won't exactly be under pressure, but I think the season will start to be coloured a lot more negatively than it was a few weeks ago. You know, I think Spurs kind of will be threatening to sort of limp to the end of it, and people will remember this week if there's another defeat as a really bad one. And I think, the outlook of the season will feel much more gloomy than it would have done perhaps otherwise. I mean, fair?
Yeah. And the more I think about it, the more it's been a while since we've seen a really convincing Spurs performance, and that's got to be a worry. And you talk about the clunkiness of the attack. Well, and I agree. And he keeps saying, you know, I want more bang for my buck from the attackers. But we are near the end of an end of the season. He's had a long time and a lot of time on the training pitch, more than normal this season, compared to every other season because of lack of games. So I do think it's fair to sort of question why that is. And I can't remember exactly when this was said. I'm not sure if it was me asking the question, but earlier this season, I think when things were going well, we sort of he was saying how he Noy finds the first 6 months of his time at a club the rocky period when people are questioning his methods and get some dodgy results, but it picks up. And he was very bullish, as he often is, that the second half of the season would be a lot stronger than the first half of the season. And it just hasn't worked out the way it just hasn't worked out that way this season. And I don't know whether that's just the level of the Premier League, the injuries, all these kind of different things. But back to the game against Chelsea. I mean, like I said, I watched the second half of Chelsea the other day and they were really, really good. I know everyone knows how poor they've been at times this season, but Madueke looked a real threat down the right. Gallagher was very, very impressive, and I'm sure fans will be watching him closely, given there's a good chance he joins Spurs in the summer. Cole Palmer, obviously, everyone knows about, but there was a resilience and a spirit and a quality about Chelsea, which we haven't seen anywhere near enough this season in that second half against Aston Villa, and they were lucky not to win. So yeah, if they have anything more like that again. Again, with Pochettino, obviously that adds that factor into this game. Then Spurs are going to be in for a difficult afternoon, and we've got Liverpool after that. You know, it's City to come. It's. I think you're right. I think Postecoglou is definitely the right man. I like when they're good, they're so good, and you've got to think about how bad it was before. Even though I know Conte took him to the Champions League, but when from a sort of purist point of view, and results, it can be great, and I think they can still get there definitely. But this is, as you say, sort of has a chance of ending the season on a sour note, and I think they could do with a result and quite quickly and a performance.
You just know that Chelsea are going to be bang up for that game. Although I think on the flip side, they're mentally pretty fragile. I think if they concede and are struggling, the crowd could easily get on their back, Pochettino's back. Be interesting to see if Pochettino keeps saying how much he loves Spurs in the pre-match press conference again, which he did before the first game. I suppose there's some interesting selection calls from Ange just to finish. One was Højbjerg, another arguably Kulusevski, although I think Kulusevski made a lot of sense. But Højbjerg, he did okay.
I don't think he did so badly that, you know, he had a poor game.
Do you think he stayed in for Thursday?
I would have thought it was probably more of a message sent to Yves Bissouma that you need to buck up your ideas, because he's clearly the man, unless they buy someone else, in the long term for this project. And when he's playing, back to what I was saying, when they're good, they're very, very good. And that's definitely the case with Yves Bissouma. Whereas Højbjerg, I think we're all expecting him to leave in the summer. So it doesn't seem to make much sense to persevere, if that's what you really think is the sort of long-term strategy, with a player who's likely not to be here anymore. And I don't think he did really enough to really definitely warrant retaining his place. He's been quite effective off the bench, hasn't he? But when he started, I think that worked out to be his seventh start in the Premier League this season. The first game they won 2-0, which is actually their last clean sheet at home, which is quite worrying. October 23rd against Fulham, 2-0 win. But the other, all the other results, they've either lost or they've drawn. So it's, you know, it's unfair to pin it on one player, but I don't think he's, you know, he's really done enough on that front. And then, yeah, I think Maddison needs to improve. And I don't think he can have too many complaints if he is benched.
Yeah. Højbjerg starting, I think, was a big call, especially after Anne said at the press conference that Spurs needed to double down on their approach during the game. It very much wasn't doubling down, I think, picking Højbjerg. It was a kind of acceptance that there needed to be a bit more cover in front of the back four. But oddly, it was the kind of game where actually Arsenal let Spurs be a bit more on the front foot. So his kind of slightly more erratic passing, which admittedly is kind of normally more adventurous than some of the others, I don't know, he was kind of costly. I probably would like to see Bissouma back on the side for Chelsea, but then he's been obviously very up and down. I think that's a bit of a problem area for Ange. Again, the balance there in that midfield just doesn't seem right at the moment, and hasn't for quite a long time. But look, we will be back. Are you going to Stamford Bridge, Tom?
Yeah.
We will try and be back with the reaction pod after that game, possibly a bigger pod with Marcus and Tom Allnutt beforehand to get into some of these issues in a bit more detail. But for now, thank you for listening.